The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. And welcome to all of you who are joining us this morning from your own place. So we're finishing a session, our October session this morning. And as you know, normally we would, during Anga, we would finish with a Dharma encounter. But we'll instead be doing a mando this morning, which is basically an informal question and answer discussion. And so this gives us a chance, us here in this hall, a chance to hear from you and to sort of go through the screen a little bit. Many of you were sitting with us during the week in the One Continuous Thread from various places across the country and in other countries as well. And doing that within your own day. So many of you had to do work. Some of you were living with partners, with children. Some of you were living alone in all different kinds of situations. So this morning we'll meet here together. We've been studying the 37 verses on the practice of a bodhisattva, the Sangha. And what I wanted to do this morning was to focus on the practice, the meta-practice of loving kindness. And most are familiar with this in terms of the four measurables or the divine abidings of a loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. We are chanting this at the end of each morning's zazen. It is a meditation practice. It goes back to the time of the Buddha. So this is an original teaching and practice in Buddhism and is common, I think, through all the schools of Buddhism. There are various ways in which it can be taken up, both within meditation and also on the fly. So I wanted to focus today on loving kindness and say a few words before we open it up to questions and comments. So in the middle length discourses is one place where the Buddha speaks of this. And he describes it, he teaches it this way. So he's really giving us instruction here in how to practice this. He says, dwell suffusing one quarter with a mind filled with loving kindness, and then a second, and then a third, and a fourth quarter. Dwell suffusing the entire world, up and down, across, everywhere, and equally. Dwell pervading the entire world with your heart permeated with loving kindness. Abundant, exalted, measureless, free from hatred, free from affliction. Just as if a mighty trumpeter were to make a proclamation to the four quarters, so by this meditation, by this liberation of the heart through loving kindness, you leave nothing, no one untouched, nothing and no one unaffected throughout the entire world. So this is a very clear and beautiful presentation of how to engage in the practice of loving kindness. Yesterday in my talk, I talked about the importance of the centrality of the study and realization of mind in Buddhism. I read from a teaching in which it said that to understand ultimate reality, the way things are, is to gain insight into mind. They are the same. Because mind determines whether we're in bondage in samsara and to samsara, or whether we realized peace, the release, the liberation of nirvana. Everything we experience is dependent on mind because mind is the creator of all experience, of all states. Therefore, it's essential to meditate on mind. So in this instruction in loving kindness, you see the inseparable relationship between the bringing forth of loving kindness and mind. Another teacher said, we need to depend on mind to pacify, to find that peace. Understand that when you understand the nature of mind, you will attain knowledge of everything. We'll understand everything because if the mind is free, then everything is free. So it's said that at the moment of the Buddha's enlightenment, he said, between heaven and earth, all creatures and I at the same time realize liberation. And I mentioned yesterday that this does not mean that at that moment everyone was free of suffering, and at that moment everyone was liberated from suffering, and that at that same moment everyone was free of suffering. That's what the Buddha realized. That suffering and mind are inseparable. They're the same. But they're not inevitable. It's not the nature of mind. Suffering isn't a permanent fixture of the mind. It's something we do with the mind. It's something that takes place in the mind. I also said that in this line about that if we understand, if mind is free, everything is free. If we understand the nature of mind, then all things are understood. That means about the nature of all things. And that it doesn't mean that we will know everything. We don't suddenly know how to play a piano if we've never played a piano. We don't suddenly understand physics if we've never studied physics. I mean, obviously it doesn't mean that. Nor does it mean that understanding things, all things, self and other, and of course this is talking about deep understanding, it doesn't mean that we will suddenly then know what to do in every situation. We will know how to meet every situation within wisdom and compassion. It doesn't mean that we will automatically know how to be skillful in all situations. So we need to be clear about this. And the faith mind, it says, do not remain in dualistic states. Avoid such pursuits carefully. Really reflect on that. The dualistic states, that is samsara, seeing things in opposition, seeing things as opposed to each other. And inevitably, in essence, in conflict, that these are pursuits, that we can pursue things, we can inhabit ourselves, we can bring forth the mind in such a way that we pursue dualistic states, we pursue our suffering. And so he goes on to say in the faith mind to come directly into the unity, the harmony with this reality, just simply say, when doubts arise, not to. Reflect on that as the ultimate truth, not to, not divided, not opposed. And in this not to, nothing is separate and nothing is excluded. The Buddha said, dwell pervading the entire world with your heart permeated with loving kindness, abundant, reaching everywhere, exalted, magnanimous, measureless, indefinable, it's not a thing, and free from hatred and affliction. It leaves nothing untouched and nothing unaffected. So, if we think of the cultivation of and the manifestation of loving kindness, just to focus on that one aspect, when we engage in that practice, when we're bringing forth loving kindness within ourselves, what do we encounter? We don't just encounter loving kindness. We encounter everything that seems to inhibit or block or dampen or make obscure or absent our loving kindness. Right? If that weren't true, we would just be permeated with loving kindness at all times. But that's not our experience. And so in taking up this practice, this meditation, we will and must encounter all the things that bind us to our lack of loving kindness. And so in practicing this, we practice a ceasing from harm. We practice a letting go of all of those things, seeing into and letting go of all of those things that seem to obstruct us from the bringing forth of that loving kindness which exists within all of us. And then we practice a bringing forth, right? A cultivating, a generating of that loving kindness. And so we can think of this in terms of the pure precepts of ceasing from harm and practicing good, actualizing good for others. We can think of this as a letting go practice, letting go of what obstructs, and generating what is loving kindness. We can think of this as an interruption of the cycle, which binds us to our lack of loving kindness, and establishing a new path. This is another way of speaking about right effort. So in the actual practice of this, what happens as we're encountering these obstacles? So drawing from the Visuddhimagga, which is translated as the Path of Liberation, it's a sort of really important text written by Buddhaghosa, who was a 5th century master, who sort of brought together the essential teachings of the Theravadan tradition, and it's considered, since he wrote it, well, some centuries later, to be sort of the definitive text that lays out the Theravadan teachings. And in that, he has a whole chapter on the four immeasurables. And he talks about, in practicing loving kindness, that first we should review the dangers inherent within hatred and anger, which are what gets in the way of our loving kindness. And so first he said we should practice this directed towards ourself. We should direct our practice of loving kindness and generating it directed towards ourself, within ourself. And he said the reason is this, is we should make ourselves an example. Right? For whom? Well, for ourselves. We should show ourselves, right, that we have this, that we can bring this forward, that we can have this permeate our heart. And in doing that, then, we become an example to others. And once that's arisen, once that begins to arise, Buddhaghosa says we will, and we see the all the benefits of that. We see all the good qualities, how that changes us, how it transforms us, how it helps us in meeting the world in which there's so much lack of loving kindness. It will bring forth in us a natural desire to bring this forth towards others because we realize how good this is for us. And then we will naturally want that, to extend that to others. And he says, if when you're practicing cultivating loving kindness, if resentment arises towards a hostile person because you remember the wrong things done by that person, so you're sitting there, you're bringing this forth, and you're directing it towards some person, but your mind keeps going to what that person has done that has hurt you or maybe has hurt other people. And so rather than generating loving kindness, you're experiencing anger or resentment or hatred. And he says, if that arises, and maybe you can relate to this, just in case this happens for you, he says, try this. Repeatedly enter into that practice of loving kindness, but direct it towards somebody easier. Okay, if the person you're directing it towards, or whatever you're directing it towards, if your mind keeps going to what they've done that has hurt, created harm, then shift your attention to somebody that you find easier, right, where that doesn't happen, so that you can bring that loving kindness forward, and then as that gets stronger and more stable, now bring it back to that person that you were having trouble with before. He says, if in doing that resentment continues to arise, you're still angry, you bring it back to that person you consider hostile, and it still comes forth. He said, then reflect on various teachings that will guide you and encourage your patience, your development of patience. Right? And patience in the Dharma is presented as kind of the antidote to anger and hatred. I spoke about that a little bit yesterday. And so to think about those teachings, that the when we respond to anger with more anger, it just creates more suffering for ourselves and for everyone else. That having the anger doesn't actually solve any problems. It doesn't eliminate, right, the thing that is making us angry. It might motivate us to act in ways, but then we're carrying that anger with us. So even though it's motivating us, we're carrying that anger, which tends to create fires as we're trying to put out fires. And so he's saying just reflect on various teachings to try and instill faith and sort of give us confidence in why patience is so powerful and important, and to sort of give us faith in how to move forward to letting go of that anger. And he says, but if despite your efforts, the resentment does not drop away, then think about that person, if you can. And think about whether you've ever experienced them in good moments, where they maybe were doing something positive towards you, or even if they were doing it towards somebody else, or something else, where you saw them caring for something, loving something, being kind to something or someone. In other words, see those positive qualities that exist in that person to try and hold them up and help to diminish the negative qualities that keep arising. He said, if you can't find anything inspiring when you contemplate that person, you try, but you can't think about anything that you've ever seen them done that was positive, then think about the fact that the path that they're on is a painful path. They may have caused you pain, they may be causing other people pain, but the very path that they're on is also causing them pain and confusion. And he said, if the resentment continues to arise, use that as a motivator to be more diligent in being attentive to your anger, to really being mindful and meticulous within the emotion of your anger, and again, bringing forth the patience. He says, if the resentment continues to arise, then think about how that person that you experience with so much difficulty is the owner, is the sort of, is storing up all of the karma, all of the accumulated results of their own actions that will bear fruit. In other words, that the difficulty that they're causing you or us is creating a kind of a hell realm for them. And so to get angry at their karma, right, because what they're doing is a result of their karma and the conditions they're in, right, to get angry at the person, he's saying, is a little misguided. We should be getting angry at their karma, which is leading them, which is sort of influencing them, guiding them, sort of motivating them to do that. He says, if we're still struggling, we're still finding it difficult, then reflect on the good qualities of people that you find as examples for you. Enlightened beings, the Buddha, other teachers, people who have lived really healthy, positive, exemplary lives. And just think about the fact that they had to work through something such as you're experiencing right now in order to do that. In other words, you may be inspired by their example that is the fruit of very difficult moments that they experienced in their past where they were struggling just like you are now. And that can inspire us to persevere and to continue to kind of dig deeper. And then he said, if it still continues, then turn your attention to the resentment itself. In other words, rather than continuing to attend or turn our attention to this person that we're having so much difficulty with, turn it towards the resentment itself, the anger itself, and examine it. Where is it, right, that has so much power, that is occupying so much space, is taking up so much energy within us? Where do we find it? Can we find it within ourselves? Does it have certain qualities? Because we're experiencing it as though it has all of these different qualities and attributes, which is what we're experiencing. And yet when we look, where are they? Right, to begin to see into the insubstantiality of that anger. And then he says, finally, if you're still struggling with this, then consider just giving that person a gift. Offer them something. At no point in this does he say, okay, if you're still experiencing resentment, you're hopeless, right? I'm sorry, I have nothing more to offer. Give it up, right? There's no point in you continuing. He never says that, right? And why would he be offering so many different practices, so many different possibilities, right, if the resentment continues? Because that's what happens. That happens. And then we continue to turn in, and we turn in this path. And then if that, and exhausting that, then we turn towards another path. All of these are different practices. Which is another way of saying there are people or situations in which we will find it that difficult to kind of find our way in, to find shift. Fifth century. Okay, things really haven't changed a lot. And so I thought it would be helpful to just bring this out and share his teachings within this particular time in which there is, among so many other things, a fair amount of resentment, hostility, anger, directed towards persons, individuals, people, groups, things that are happening, events. And because our practice is to, and the practice of the Bodhisattva is to bring wisdom and compassion into this world, and the only way we can do that is through ourselves, we have to do it through ourselves. Whatever we might be doing, however we might become an instrument to be helping to affect shift and change in the world, in specific places, with people, within certain situations and events, we are doing that through this instrument that we are, through mind. And that's why the teachings are continually bringing our attention back to that. Continually bringing our attention back to that. You know, nowhere in the teachings do you find the Buddha saying or any enlightened master saying, okay, look, if there's an election coming up and these are the circumstances, this is what you should do. Or if you're at the mercy of a demagogue, right? Or there's incredible wealth inequality or racial injustice. Or if your planet's on fire, this is what you should do next. You will not find that in the teachings. Right? That has been left to us, as it has been in every generation. What is given to us is the fundamental, the essence. And so, and in order to return to the root, to that essence, we have to encounter everything that seems to impede our path, our journey. Okay, so this is what I wanted to take up, is how do you relate to those encouragements of a Buddhaghosa? Have you explored some of those different paths? And what have you found? How do you work with your own resentment, right? The lingering, persistent, difficult emotions that arise around certain people or situations that make it difficult not just to bring forth loving kindness, but to just live, to just be, and to see what else there is in the world. Okay, so we'll just open this up. And what I'd like to encourage in terms of those of you at home is, and Sean will be calling on you, those of you who offer to speak, is I'd like to hear, it'd be nice to hear from some of you we haven't heard from, right, that haven't spoken yet in last month or in you know, even in some of the ongoing things that we've been doing, the studies that we've been doing. So maybe some from some of you who haven't had a chance to speak. You know, if you were here and it was Dharma Encounter, you would be getting an invitation to come up and actually sit on the line and come to speak face to face. So this is kind of the same thing. And so why don't we get started, and then Sean will alternate between folks at home and those of you who are here in the Zendo. So Sean, is anybody ready? Okay. Alec?
To work with loving kindness and to try to do these things, one has to first want to offer someone loving kindness. And, you know, if I'm being completely honest with myself and really looking at my mind, there are certain people who I don't really want to offer loving kindness to. How can I sort of, how does one start really developing that urge to offer loving kindness to someone?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's a very good question to start with, because it's a question that is saying we have to start where we are, right? Which is really, really important. And where we are is not always, you know, we don't always want to own up to it, right? Because we think, oh, that shouldn't be where I am, right? I should just want to have loving kindness. But if we're honest, there are going to be people and situations that we don't want that yet. And so you can want to want it, right? You can realize you don't actually want that, but you can, some part of you in some corner within you, there can be the sense of, but that would might be a good thing somehow, some way. And so what Buddhaghosa is saying, and the teachings point to, is we can reflect on, so not wanting that for that person and being in that relationship with that person, because that's the thing we should recognize. With whoever we are feeling that resentment or bitterness or anger or hostility, we are in a very dynamic relationship with them. We don't often think of it that way, right? We're giving them space in our mind, right? We're sort of inviting them into our mind and giving them space and devoting energy, thought, emotion, right? We could be devoting that to other things, but we're devoting it to this person or this situation that we're so angry at, right? And so to think about it that way sort of might shift things a little bit. Is that really what I want to be doing, right? We usually think of that kind of devotion towards people that we love, right? Towards people that are really helpful or beneficial in our lives. And so to reflect on the unhelpful consequences of continuing to sort of dwell in that and harbor those feelings, and to imagine the benefit of being free of that. You know, what if you were free of that? And we tend to think, well, I'll be free of it when that person goes away, or they stop doing what they're doing, right? They get their shit together, right? Or they just disappear. But that's dukkha. You know, that's trying to control the world so that I don't really have to do anything. Right? And so this is a much greater ask. This is saying, rather than trying to control the world, yield within ourselves. You know, so but your point is really important. We have to want to do any of these things. Right? And so sometimes we have to work towards that. You know, that can seem like the starting place, but the starting place is actually getting to, you know, what we need to do to get to that place. And that's a perfectly valid practice. It's an honest practice, right? And when you engage it at that level, it's already happening, right? It's already beginning to shift. All right, look, folks. Right, this is something we do together. So don't use that screen to, like, you know, not show up.
Okay. John Robinson, be the first person asking.
Okay. So, John?
So, I'll try and tell this story briefly. It sort of ties together what you were speaking of today with sort of the last two verses. I was 5, and my parents went away, and they gave me as a little gift this little pouch with like 5 little gold nuggets, fake little gold nuggets. And at my daycare, there was the daughter of the daycare liked them and came to me and said, "Can I have one?" And I gave her one. And then not much longer later, she came to me and said, "I lost that one. Can I have another one?" And I gave her another one. And moments later, she came to me and said, "I lost that one. Can I have another?" And clearly, we all know I was getting played. I was not aware I was getting played as a 5-year-old boy. And I literally gave her all of the nuggets. And as I later on in life, as I reflected on that, I imputed on myself a sense of loss and a sense of sort of righteous indignation. But the truth is the me that arose had no sense of loss. It was simply I was asked and I gave. Even to down to the last one. I don't even remember having the thought other than, oh, that's my last one, not a sense of loss around it. And I guess my question is not in that instance, I suppose the resentment as I feel was more towards myself for being, you know, such a sucker, but at the same time, not because there was no loss in those moments. But my question is, related to that, reflecting on the painful path that someone else is on, like what would a bodhisattva have done that would have been different? Because I'm not sure that me not experiencing loss helped her any, because clearly she was playing me. And so as I reflect on, you know, the painful path that someone else might be on, I don't know how to intervene or be of benefit in a way that I hope my question makes sense.
That's a kind of a sweet story. So clear, you know, there's a mind of innocence, you know, that is just, you just give. You give one, you give two, you give three. You just give because she lost one, for goodness sake, right? And so there's that mind of innocence. And so the bodhisattva, you know, the mind of selflessness has a kind of innocence. You know, one of the qualities of an old, mature, wise being is a kind of naivete. You know, they're not a conniver. They're not a strategist. You know, there's a sweetness, but there's a knowing. Right, so perhaps a bodhisattva would have chosen to do exactly the same thing, but do it knowingly. They would see what was happening. They would know exactly what was happening, but they would choose to give all of those golden nuggets because based on what they were seeing, they might have thought that that would actually bring benefit. Or they might not have. You know, they might have done something else. And so, you know, and this is what makes this challenging, is that you're, you know, the bodhicitta is liberating your mind and the mind of others, right? And so in a moment where you might see what would really be beneficial for you, right, how you act on that, then how is that to do that in a way that is also beneficial for that person, you know? And sometimes those may seem to be not the same, not exactly in alignment, you know, that you may decide not to. You know, you may decide to just give all of them away because you realize that's really good for you. You know, it's good. It's good just releasing all possessiveness, you know, and just not having any grasping. And you may realize, but it may not be really good for that person, right? And so then there's your moment, you know, of consideration, you know, in terms of how you respond. But I would say just, you know, in essence the bodhisattva, you know, more and more, you know, we are seeing the world and working within things and with people for more of a place of knowing, of understanding. So rather than just reacting to what we might see on the surface, an emotion, an anger, you know, a behavior, you know, as Buddhaghosa was saying, to see into some of the circumstances, conditions, and karma that is leading this person to manifest in this way at this moment. We see beyond the surface, right? And even if we don't know much about that person, you know, if we know a bit about ourselves, if we have studied ourselves and those things within ourselves, we will see them in that person. And that helps to generate compassion for them. Okay. Gokhan.
During Sesshin, I was trying some giving and taking practice. And with sometimes with people in the room who I saw I was feeling resentment towards, sometimes people who were not in the room. And in each case, it felt like they needed me to take, or what was fear, and I was offering them peace. And then I started to realize that really I was like healing my own fear.
Exactly. That's right. Thank you for your answer. Right. In that moment, you're seeing into self and other are one essence. You know, that even if you see clearly that within that person that you are receiving, right, in order to receive it, you have to, you know, have that seed within yourself. In other words, there's a kind of resonance. It's like two strings plucked in tune. And that's part of what gives it power, right? It's not an abstract thing, right? It's flowing into you. And when you give that peace, that already resides within them as well, right? And so in a way, you're experiencing, and you experience it in an embodied way, the mutual arising, right? It's an aspect of, you know, the practice of equalizing self and other, of seeing the equality of self and other. You possess those qualities. That person possesses those qualities.
Okay. Thank you. This teaching on resentment is very helpful. And I really appreciate all the nuances of how to deal with resentment, you know, how to meet it in practice. But I'm struck at the same time that this is different from direct anger, that, or my question is, how is this different from direct anger? I think of a story that I heard once of a child being abducted, and the parent took a club, interrupted the abduction, and killed the abductor to save the child. That's a very dramatic example, but there are many moments when a certain fire is required to protect innocent people or even to protect oneself. So how is the passion of anger different from the mind habit of resentment?
Okay. So within Buddhism, anger is one of the afflictions, the kleshas, is sort of covers the whole range of aversion. So from very subtle forms of irritation and annoyance, impatience, anger, ridicule, hatred, violence. So think of it, resentment is just one of the shades that exists within this whole spectrum of aversion, right? Which is basically, you know, against, you know, standing against, no, is wanting to in some way diminish or destroy or, none of these states have inherent existence. None of them have inherent qualities. We experience them the way we do because of our physiological, emotional, psychological makeup as human beings, and because of our conditioning, our socialization, our karma. And because we experience certain things and they have certain qualities because of that sort of physical genetic disposition, but also society and our experiences have informed us about how to understand what that emotion means. Right? And it is also, we've seen many, many displays of how people respond or act out of those emotions. And we've also been told as individuals how we should act out of all those emotions. So we may, you know, depending on how we have appeared in the world, we may have been encouraged to act on our anger. Right? It's okay to do that. You know, when I was playing sports as a young fellow, you know, that was often used by the coaches, you know, to get angry and, you know, and turn that against the enemy, right? just other boys, right, who are playing the other side in this game, right? Or being born in a form where you were told you were not allowed to be angry. That's not a good emotion. You can be nice, but you can't be angry. Okay. Or maybe you've just been silenced altogether, right? We just don't want to hear from you at all. And so that's where, you know, recognizing that these states don't have an inherent quality, but they do have a lot of karmic history. And so how we hear these teachings and how we respond to them, we're hearing from our own place. I spoke about this a little bit yesterday. And so, you know, that teaching, you know, even if somebody cuts off your head when you haven't done the slightest thing, and through the power of your compassion, just take their misdeeds upon yourself. And so what if, as a senior student last night, one of our female senior students pointed out, she said, you know, that sounds like a very sort of, could be looked at as a very sort of gender, you know, loaded presentation, you know, so for a guy to hear that, where, you know, sort of grown up to be the assertive, the aggressor, the aggressive one, you know, versus if I've grown up in a way that I've been abused or been mistreated much of my life by individuals or by society, then how do I receive that teaching? You know, and is a way of responding to that teaching to stand up and say, no, no more. You can't do this, right? And so I talked about the Bodhisattva precepts yesterday and how from the Mahayana perspective, that sometimes out of compassion and reverence for life, for others and for ourselves, sometimes we need to act in a way that would seem from the outside to go against the grain of what that teaching seems to be saying, but it's not, because they're not rigid rules. They're not about following the letter of the rule or the Dharma. It's about the intention behind it, which is to liberate. And so if part of our path of liberation is to first find our voice, or to just acknowledge that we have anger because we've never acknowledged that, or to develop the skills of actually being able to express it because we've never done that, right? Whereas for somebody else who's been expressing it all their lives freely, then to, you know, be humbled and really constrain themselves with retain, you know, sort of hold that in, renounce that, you know, is what they may need to do, right? And so we can also look at that not just as individuals, but also as groups or as movements, you know, and we see that where there are, you know, masses sometimes will step forth, you know, and in one voice but with a million different minds and with different intentions, right? And so there is something collective that's happening, but it's also happening on the level of individual minds, but there's something that happens that's collaborative, right? Which is not really, you know, in control of any one person, you know, which is both its power and, you know, can also be its wildness. Okay. Okay. Somebody in the room like to speak? Joshua.
Sorking. I mean, I was thinking about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission at the end of apartheid, where people had to sit down and face the perpetrators, the people who had killed their family, and forgive them because of this idea that of Ubuntu, which is, I cannot be fully human if you're not fully human. And it's kind of like what you were saying to Alec. I can't carry this and be fully human. And these teachings, and you know, the passage that you quoted from the Buddha and loving kindness practice, he talked about the heart, right? And we tend to use the word mind, right? That this is a mind training, and it's, and you know, metaphorically, we think of the mind somehow up here in our body and the heart somewhere down here. And that, you know, this thing that we're doing in our practice and Zazen is up here, right? And it's not here. So my question is that really not training correctly to have an
described, yes, that is not training correctly,
right?
That nothing is divided, heart and mind. I mean, the sense of heart and mind being divided, or you know, mind and matter, is one of the great tragedies of human history, right? And so, you know, significantly, you know, shin, the word for mind, is heart mind. When we chant the Maha Prajnapiti Heart Sutra, right, is heart and mind. So we just need to keep knowing that, keep remembering that, particularly if we find ourselves drawn, sort of inclined to be thinking in our mind, you know, of it as one or another, you know, to keep bringing them together. I mean, the fact is if we're actually practicing and in contact with what's happening within us, we will see that they're indivisible, right? That every thought has some quality. You know, a thought is just not just words in our mind. It has some embodied quality, some emotive quality, you know. And so we're seeing that relationship between mind and body, or mind and heart. And, you know, that we're in this practice that Buddhaghosa is describing, you know, you could say you're using your mind to cultivate your heart, but, you know, that's just a clumsy way and a not even accurate way of describing what's really happening, which is you're using that which is one unified system, right, to bring forth that very thing. You know, there in that process of the truth and reconciliation, one of the things that came to my mind when you were talking was, as they were, you know, as I in my readings about this, they were, you know, there was a lot of discussion about what to do, you know, when apartheid dissolved, and what to do with, you know, bringing the people together. And so this decision to have these truth and reconciliation hearings, and that anybody who was to come forward and take responsibility for the harm that they created. And the question was, well, how do we know if they're sincere? Right? What if they're not really sincere? And, you know, the discussion was, well, how do you measure that? How can you, you know, judge that? And so they just decided, my memory is, they just decided that if somebody seems to come forth with a reasonable amount of sincerity and say, I'm willing to go through this process, then they would just accept that. And it's sort of the meaning of the vastness of this, of the compassion and the recognition of the possibility of humanity after so much tragedy and pain, meeting the reality of human nature and realizing this is not a perfect system and it won't yield perfect results, but it is something we can do. Gail?
Yeah, thank you. This is sort of along the lines of what everyone's been speaking about, but, you know, coming into the election and working with the Bodhisattva, trying to be a Bodhisattva or just fully human, I feel that there's like a force that we're dealing with that is, it's so frightening to me. And yet these are other people, just people. But I don't know how to not take it, be hurt and frightened personally about what's could happen, is happening. How do I help the people around me who are falling apart and I'm falling apart? And yet I know that we won't fall apart and we'll just go on doing the best we can. But I don't know how to put some of this stuff right now.
Well, I think of the, was it Patachara? Who was the woman who came to the Buddha having lost everything, her family, everyone, Patachara, and was kind of out of her mind, and the Buddha said, gather yourself. And I imagine him, I hear him saying that with some force, right? Gather yourself. That's what we need to do. That's not all we need to do. But to recognize, I mean, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about with Alec, that if we recognize how when we assume a certain state of disassembly, how does the world appear to us in that state? How do we hear? How do we see? How do we respond? Right? Disassembled. We've all had the experience as practitioners, if we practiced enough, of how, you know, at the beginning of a period of intense practice, you know, things are coming apart and there's a lot of stress and woe and misery and sorrow. And then through sitting, nothing has changed in your life. But as a result of deep practice, your actual experience of it, the way you see it, the way you hear it, the way you think about it, the way you respond to it, has changed. That's a real thing. And that ties in directly with the teaching that the world is mind. And so to gather ourselves in a time, in a moment, to take refuge, because we realize not only do we need this, but the world needs this. In terms of the world needs us as individuals to participate well. And to participate well means to participate with some reasonable well-being. And so we have to want to. We have to want that, you know, which means we have to see, how am I disassembling myself? Because while the forces are strong, and you say there's a force, but what is that force? What is that force, Gail?
Mind.
Mind? No, don't give me a Buddhist answer. I mean, in other words, when you say there's a force that's out there, you know, what are you experiencing when you call it a force? What are you referring to?
What I'm experiencing is almost like a personal attack. Like, so that is not what is happening, really. It is like a force. When I look at the rallies and I think, where will all this go? How did it come to be, even? And I understand structurally, politically, how it came to be. And I also, from a Buddhist perspective, can understand that how a force can gather like that and come to be.
Yeah. Okay. You know, it's like when I say, oh, my life's falling apart, right? And somebody says, well, what's going on? And I say, well, you know, I'm having trouble at work and there's stuff happening at home and I, you know, I'm getting sick and I'm not feeling well and I'm a little bit behind with my bills. So when you ask me for more information to examine my life is coming apart, what I talk about is specific things, right? Each of which needs to be addressed in its own way. Now, clearly there's an interrelatedness, but in terms of addressing that, I need to turn my attention to specific things, right? But in my mind, like you said, it's not that something is actually being directed specifically to you, but in my mind, the mind conflates and just takes all of these things and sort of bundles them up into one catastrophe, right? Which we then actually begin to experience that way, and then our language follows suit. You know, the world is coming apart. Or the country is coming apart. Well, what is the country? Right? And when we say coming apart, what are we actually talking about? And this is in no way to diminish or to ignore that there are things that are in trouble. But when we think of it that way, and this is why language is so important, the way we talk about things to ourselves and to each other creates the world. So the more we speak that way, the more the world appears that way in our mind. And the more we sort of react emotionally, which means we're less and less examining what's really going on because we're just sort of experiencing it from that those strong emotions. Right? And so this comes back to, you know, gather ourselves, you know, have some stability of mind. And, I'm talking to people who are like, I'm just too undone, I'm too agitated, I'm too upset to sit. Well, do something about that, right? Because it's like I'm too busy to eat, I'm sorry, right? I just don't have time to eat, right? We don't let that happen, not for too long, right? Because the signs, the feedback is unequivocal. Right? And so the thing is, we cannot see the signs coming in when we don't nourish ourselves with the thing that we know we need to be doing. Right? Anybody else? Samson?
Yeah. I just have a straightforward question, I think. When should I be practicing this, both sitting and outside of, off the cushion? And I ask this because normally I'm just working on the practice that I'm given, and that's like, well, I'm either working on it or I'm fantasizing. But sitting, I don't think of normally doing loving practice, and I would like to. So do I do half and half as a kind of as much as I can take? Mm-hmm. And then also, if I'm not sitting, is it when I'm waiting for a meal?
So, you know, earlier I said, you know, that this is a meditation practice to do on the meditation seat and on the fly. And so if we think of, like, here we get up in the morning during session, we're in the Zendo by 4:30. And then by 7:30, we're out of the Zendo. So let's call that a practice period, just for the sake of discussion. And in that practice period, we do zazen, we do kinhin, we do zazen, we do some, we chant the four immeasurables, right? Which is a moment where you're not just chanting, but you're visualizing, right? Because you're saying, may all beings. So those are not just words, right? They shouldn't just be words that your mouth is speaking, but they should be words that are directing yourself to people that you're holding in your mind. You're speaking to someone. You know, when I do it, I as a personal liturgy, I say, may all beings. And then the rest of the time I do it, I say, may you. May you know compassion and the root of compassion. May you, you know, live in equity. Because I'm speaking directly to someone, right? And so I just have found that helpful, right, to make that very clear in my mind. And then we do service, and then we do orioki, right? So within that, what I'm calling a practice period, we do these different practices. And so my encouragement is that within a practice period of meditation, that you have a root practice. You may have a beginning practice, right, to get yourself settled, which may be the breath, right, because you're doing other practices. And then at some point during that zazen period of practice, to do some metta practice. And depending on how much time you have, and this is where, you know, you can be flexible. So if you have an extended, and I do this, you know, when I'm doing solo retreats or I'm doing a hermitage and I have extended periods of time, I'll extend some of those practices and make them more significant, right? And I even have shorter and longer versions of different sutras or liturgies that I chant regularly. So if I don't have much time, I might do it in a minute or two. If I have more time, it might take 10 or 15 minutes, depending on the text or whatever I'm working with. So I've developed different ways of working to adapt to different sort of amounts of time that I have. And then the lion's share of what I'm doing during that period of time is my root practice of zazen. So I sort of keep things in place, although even that might shift, right? If I'm in the middle of something or working something where I realize I need to work more with bringing forth loving kindness, you know, and so that might, I make give that more time. You know, I was, before the talk, full disclosure, before the talk I gave yesterday, I was feeling just kind of grumpy, right? And I thought, that's just not a great state of mind to be in, you know, in offering the 37 verses. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with it, but that I didn't want to be giving that, right? So as I was sitting here preparing, I did giving and receiving, right? For myself, right? And so that's where, that's on the fly, right? Where there's a moment where you're seated or you're, you know, in an office, or I used to do it when I was on the subway, and I would be sitting near or opposite somebody, and I wanted to offer something to that person. Or sometimes it was a family or a couple or somebody, something was happening where there was distress, right? And it wasn't appropriate for me to go over and, you know, intervene. But I used my mind. Ed?
So, Roshi, my question is, in practicing the four immeasurables and metapractice, you know, when I would come home from working at the school, there was a, I had a, an incident with one of the principals, and we would argue about really the treatment of students. And I would get into that, you know, I'm right. And then when I would come home to practice, you know, I would watch my mind support that, you know, I'm right and that she's wrong. And then realizing that within, you know, my practice, that's not why I'm doing this, is to prove my rightness. And then through the different practice of the, you know, of visualization, you know, it shifted and I was able to see her doing compassionate acts and understand that she also has a particular, you know, defense of why she treats students this way. And our relationship shifted. And it was, you know, the practice itself and seeing my own mind and my own desire to be right was hard, but just observing it. So, but what's interesting is that, you know, I no longer work with her. And we, you know, we've developed actually a very good working relationship. But that person, and I've had this with other people throughout, you know, like John said, through the course of my life, who still come up in my sitting and in my life. And, you know, I feel like in terms of the practice itself really helped that relationship. I mean, it became a strong relationship. But why is it that, you know, what is it about, I guess it, I'm answering this, is my karma. Why do those people still come up? And like you said, you know, in your talk, is that sometimes these relationships teach us things. What is that next step in my practice? To like, why does that person keep coming in?
Well, you know, the relationship doesn't end when, you know, you stop working with that person or stop seeing them even, you know, in a sense. Remember that from a Buddhist perspective, everything we experience, the seeds, the sort of seed experience of that lives within our deepest consciousness. And then because of karmic and conditions, it arises in certain moments. And in that moment, that's seen as a kind of propitious moment to address the energy of that memory or that thought or that relationship, because it's arisen and it's not an accident, right? It doesn't mean that there's a plan, but it's that it's arisen because of you and your mind and your karma. And that's a moment to develop it in a good way, to respond to it in a way that it nurtures it, if, you know, to pacify it if it's troubled. But we're still in relationship. You know, and sometimes the people that we have most difficulty with are the people we're the most in relationship with, right? Because we spend so much time with them in our mind. You know, the other thing in terms of the recommendations by Buddhaghosa, I was thinking in terms of just thinking about that person and the karma they're creating. You know, one aspect of that is I remember when I would sometimes get into things with my teacher, where I would want something or propose something and we didn't agree, and I would argue it and he wouldn't agree, and, you know, and I would walk away, you know, huffing, you know, not happy. And that one of the ways I worked with that was I would just reflect on the fact that, you know, I had a certain role in my relationship with him. I was a student. He was my teacher. But also we had different roles here, right? He was the abbot, and I had my own responsibilities. And I would reflect on the fact that I didn't know what it was like to be in his position. You know, I knew that it was different from mine. I knew that his responsibilities were different than mine, that his vision was different from mine. I knew all of that intellectually. But I would kind of remind myself and step into that and realize I'm coming from my own place, which has a validity, right, and a perspective. But the decision, you know, his decision is coming from his place, which you know, he has a particular kind of responsibility which was different from mine. And that helped me to sort of get out of my righteousness a little bit, right? And that love we have of being right and just continuing to remind ourselves of how right we are. And we just keep coming up with more and more reasons why we are continue to be right, still right. and then it comes back to, okay, like, what am I doing? You know, what am I cultivating, right? This is my world, right? This is my life. It's now, right? Is this what I want? You know, is this really what I want to be developing? It also makes me think of when I was with my dad, when he was alive, and I had a varied relationship with him. And at a certain point, with the help of my teacher, because I was very judgmental of him, and bad choices he made and behaviors he possessed that I judged harshly and had for years. And I realized that's sort of the basis of my relationship with him. Those attitudes that I have and the way that I cultivate those, for me, sort of is the lion's share of the relationship I have with him. And he was coming near to the end of his life, and I realized, is that what I want? And I realized, no, it's not what I want. And I had kept holding on to my rightness because I wanted him to change. And what my teacher helped me to realize was that I needed to let my father make his own decisions about how he wanted to make his life work, even if it didn't seem to be working the way I wanted it to. And so I really practiced not judging him. And I mean, I really practiced it. And it really shifted for me, where I just let him be who he was. And love him. Because when I let go of all of that judgment, that's what was there. And it was actually easy to love him when that judgment dropped away. And I really felt like something really significant changed in our relationship. I never told him anything about this. I didn't say, okay, Dad, this is what I'm practicing now. I just tried to be that. But I really felt like in some way it communicated. Because our relationship changed in a way that I would have bet you good money couldn't have happened prior to that. And that was very important for me to just see, to see that. Diego?
Thank you. The practice of the gift really resonated with me and maybe my experience when I have encountered a difficult person, and I have practiced or tried to practice loving kindness. I find myself sometimes not only making up with that person, but also trying to please that person, and you know, trying to give that person a gift. But is it really out of generosity, or is it my ego coming, you know, across a good intention, right? And again, the self entangling a situation that had been solved in a good way and with loving kindness. So how do we engage with that gift that it's really genuine and stays that way?
Well, there's a practice called exchanging self and other. And there are different ways in which that's taken up, but, you know, kind of on a simple level, to just, you know, really try to enter into that person and into their views. You know, I was just reading recently sort of different comments by different people who are quite supportive and very devoted to our president, and the reasons why, you know, they were stating their reasons, what they think is going so great and he's doing so well. And I was really trying to, you know, which is, you know, different views than my own. And I was really trying to sort of enter in and really reflect on, you know, that way of seeing things and reflect on, you know, what they were saying from a place of being more, you know, closer to it. You know, not just standing back and, you know, in my views that are different, but really trying to look at that, sort of seeing those views as valid because they see them as valid. They're acting upon them as valid, right? In the same way that any experience we have has validity because it's happening. It may be helpful or not, it may be skillful or not, it may be enlightened or deluded, but it's valid because it appears. And so to ignore that or deny that is just denying reality. And so to allow ourselves to enter into that sense of validity, this is, which means we have to let go of our opinions about it for that moment, right? Otherwise, we can't do that. We can't enter into it. And what we're doing in that moment is we're letting go of some piece of ourself. We're letting go of some aspects of our attachments to those views, right? This is practice, right? And so, and it's also, in a sense, giving that person a dignity in our mind, you know, and a respect by acknowledging their view as valid, right? And that can be a very difficult and almost seemingly precarious thing to do when we feel like that view is dangerous, right? Or is being acted upon in a way that is actively creating harm. And it is much more difficult. But it's no less valid. It doesn't mean it's good. It doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything about it. I'm talking about just at a very basic level, in the same way that when we see something arise within ourselves that we realize is not good, it's not helpful, it's not something we want to encourage, it has validity, right? If we don't just accept, yes, I think this, or yes, I feel this, or yes, I have done this, then we're choosing to, in a sense, live in an alternate universe, right, than the one that actually exists. And so sometimes that's the great austerity of patience, is to actually meet the ground where it is. And then, you know, the world is vast and wide, and we can then move, but from that place of reality, of something, of what is true. Okay. So, maybe one more?
Okay. This is hard to articulate, but I found this whole time that we're living through to be a profound gift, really, because the only way I can deal with it is to throw myself more deeply into practice. There's no escape outside of it. There is no escape. And what I'm struggling with right now is from the faith mind to set up what we like against what we dislike is the disease of the mind. And so I can't even articulate the question, but I have a preference. The preference is not just based on what I perceive as good for me. The preference is what I perceive to be a benefit to the whole world. But how do I practice that? I mean, I guess I don't understand. Like Dido always used to say, you know, to not set up what you like against what you dislike. And then he would always say, but I love chocolate ice cream, you know. So it seemed that there was a way that one could have a preference or something. Yeah. I can't even articulate the questions you can remember. Such a hard time, but I don't want to get stuck. I don't want to set up a duality, one against the other. How do I hold the both of them the both of them. And am I lying to myself? Is it impossible to get to the point where I could never say, I don't care who wins on election day? That would be such a lie. So I'm trying to reconcile that and make it a little clearer so I can practice it.
So let's say your neighbor has very different views from you that you find very difficult. And so you build a wall between your properties.
Okay.
To keep them out. All right. The wall doesn't know barrier. It's just stone and mortar. It doesn't know division. It doesn't know hatred. It's just stone and mortar. Right. No hindrance in the mind, no hindrance, no fear. No walls in the mind. And so in having your preference, in seeing something and believing in something that you believe is for the good, just do that without creating duality in the mind. Avoid those pursuits diligently. In other words, in pursuing what you believe is true, avoid turning that into a dis-ease of the mind by creating divisions, us and them, right? That's our practice. And it means we have to become good at seeing when we are doing that, right? And the signs abound if we pay attention. And it also means when we're in the midst of wall building, right, that we see that knowingly, we see it for what it is, right? And so it doesn't in any way, you know, and really we need to say this over and over again and understand this, it doesn't in any way, this is not by emphasizing, you know, the inner work, the practice of heart and mind and non-attachment and cultivating wisdom, you know, it's not just for me. That's the whole deal, that I'm doing this for everyone. Because there is no boundary. And in closing, I would just like to say that because this is a challenging time, in the next week or so, at least, is going to be that. And Sean, were you going to talk at all at the end about the meetings?
Sure.
Okay. We're going to be offering some things over the next week to help everybody hang together. But you know, when things are difficult, we need to be more conscientious. We need to be more diligent. That's what helps us as practitioners. Having a path is only helpful if we're walking on the path, right? Having three treasures is only helpful if we're taking refuge in the three treasures, right? Being a practitioner of meditation is only helpful when we're when we're practicing meditation in our lives. And so, and the more those forces seem to be at play inside and around us, and we see ourselves disassembling in different ways, those are signals calling to us. Those are messengers calling to us to return to what we know, to do what we know. And so in the next few weeks, let's please be diligent about this, right? This is something we need for ourselves, we can give to each other, and we can give in our own small ways to the world, along with whatever else we might be doing in active, hands-on, you know, deliberate manners. Dwell pervading the entire world with your heart permeated with loving kindness. Let that be abundant, exalted, measureless, and free from hatred and affliction. And when hatred and affliction arise, know what to do. And if you don't know what to do, ask. Inquire. Right? Because you do actually know what to do already. Thank you for coming and being here with us all today. I hope the rest of your day is splendid. And thank you for those of you who are here with us during the week. It was nice to have you with us. And again, let's really practice this next period of time that we're going into as practitioners. Okay? We have received a gift, a great legacy, a great inheritance. All right? So please let's open the box, take out the gift, and benefit from it. Okay? Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.